Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. Welcome to episode 54, where we are discussing Gert Hofstede's 1990 article, Measuring Organizational Cultures, a qualitative and quantitative study across 20 cases, published in Administrative Science Quarterly. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
Hi, this is Ralph calling in from Albuquerque, New Mexico, also in the United States.
This is Jared calling you from Sydney, Australia.
And hi, this is Fritjof coming to you from Delft in the beautiful Netherlands.
Welcome aboard, everybody. I think we got just about the entire world covered in this one.
We're getting there.
Yeah, we don't have that many three-continent versions, so this is a good one.
Yeah, I wanted to start off for the benefit of our listeners. Just want to let you know that episode 54 is going to mark a new direction for the podcast in a couple of ways, and I just want to highlight these very briefly. First, we recognize that as many of the wonderful texts that we have covered in the course of the history of the podcast, there are some classics that we have overlooked while we've focused much more on contemporary articles in the last bit of time. So in the coming episodes, we're going to go back to some of the classics and try to plug some of those holes. So this will help broaden the base of the type of material that we've been covering. Another change that we're doing is we're going back to a two-part format for each episode. In the recent times, we've been going with a three-part division where we start with part one with the discussion of the article, and part two and part three were about the implications. And we found that the listeners seem to prefer that we sort of condense the episodes a bit and make a cleaner break between the text and the implications. So we're just going to do a two-part from now on, and we're going to set that on kind of a regular monthly schedule, like an episode a month. And in the middle of the month, we will release part one and then part two a week later. And that way, it will help with the continuity as we go through the episodes. And then finally, in order to help us with this this broader look at organization theory and management science, we are greatly expanding our cast. And this episode, we welcome two new members. There's Jared and Fritjof, and I'd like to offer them, you know, just a brief moment to introduce themselves a little bit further. Jared,
thanks, Tom. Yes, so I'm a final year PhD student at the University of Sydney Business School. I have quite a long association with the podcast, I think, first as a listener, and then for about the last year and a half, supporting the social media and newsletter aspects of the podcast. So I'm not entirely new, but this is my first time on the mic, and very much looking forward to it. My research examines strategy practices in organizations and also collaborative work across boundaries. And these are things I first became interested in while consulting on immersive workshop processes. And I'm also have a real interest in materiality and how that is used in organizations and the things that organizations do. I tend to focus on qualitative research, but rather differently, I've been recently playing more with natural language processing of large bodies of text. So I have quite a diverse range of interests.
But we're glad to have you. And certainly as a qualitative researcher qualitative researcher leanings, you're a man after my own heart, Jared.
Good to hear. I think there's a few of us on the team.
Yes.
Okay. And Fritjof, please introduce yourself.
Yes. So I'm Fritjof, also a PhD student finishing my second year. And my interests and research are processes where organizing and designing are somehow intertwined. So think for example, when people are trying to organize design processes such as product design or service design, but I'm also trying to explore what it might mean to use a design approach for organizing. And I'm also a qualitative researcher, and I mainly combine process research with pragmatism. And recently, I've got really interested in trying to explore what prospective research might be.
Okay, thank you, and welcome to you as well. And we're happy to have you both on the team. And so with that, I think we can go ahead and get on with discussing the text, which is Measuring Organizational Cultures, a Qualitative and Quantitative Study Across 20 Cases. And this was a Administrative Science Quarterly article from 1990 written by Kurt Hofstadter and several colleagues. Ralph, could you give us a quick introduction to the text?
Thanks, Tom. Well, in addition to what you said, the paper presents the results of a study on organizational cultures in 20 units from 10 different organizations in Denmark and the Netherlands. It was a mixed method study combining qualitative data from in-depth interviews and quantitative data from a questionnaire survey at each organization. The researchers had three research questions. First, can organizational cultures be measured quantitatively or only described qualitatively? Second, which operationalizable, that's a good word, and independent dimensions can be used to measure organizational cultures? And how do these dimensions relate to what is known about organizations from existing theory and research? And three, to what extent can measurable differences among the cultures of different organizations be attributed to unique features of the organizations? The authors concluded that much of the differences among the 20 units could be reduced to six independent dimensions, which we'll talk about in the course of the podcast. The organizational cultural differences that the authors found resided mainly at the level of practices as perceived by their members. Scores of the units on the six dimensions were partly explainable from organizational idiosyncrasies, but were also significantly correlated with a variety of task, structural, and control system characteristics of the units. And that's what makes this article so interesting and certainly what we consider to be one of the classics of research focused on organizational culture.
Yeah, I'd also like to add that it's in a lot of ways a follow-on from the work that Hofstadter had done in national cultures. And he basically covers a lot of that previous research in the beginning of the article. And I know that this is something that in my institution that we actually still make significant use of, because what we try to do is we try to use Hofstadter's dimensions to understand our own organizational cultural behaviors and how we have to interface with, say, like organizations from other nations. And so that was quite familiar to me.
Yes, same for me, Tom. This is my first time reading this particular paper, but I'm much more familiar with Hofstadter's earlier work, which I encountered actually in many different courses over my studies. And in fact, one university that I heard of started to get student complaints that every subject that they were taking spoke about Hofstadter. So they eventually did an audit to check just how often this was being taught in order to streamline the curriculum a bit. But yeah, this is my first taste of the organizational culture paper.
Well, that's why it's such a good article to use, because regardless of whether one perceives its overuse in certain institutions, which could be the case, it really is important work. And what's nice about the early part of the article is they go into some details. If you're not familiar with the construct of organizational culture, they provide a lot of background information on that as well as the study. And one of the things I thought was interesting, even though there's maybe not a consensus about the definition, they say that there's general agreement and about the nature of what organizational culture or corporate culture, the construct is, and it's got six features, and these are not the same as the six dimensions that they developed in the study, but the six features are that it's holistic, it's historically determined, and that could be from a range of factors, typically though by the founder, or the founders have a very strong role to play. related to anthropological concepts. That's a good one. Socioconstructed, which you can definitely see, and that comes up many times in the case of the article. It's soft. They're not really clear about exactly what they mean by that, but we can have a conversation about that. And it's also difficult to change, which is certainly what a lot of the research indicates.
Yeah, I think I can elaborate on soft. I mean, it is something that is very difficult to put your finger on, and it's rather malleable. I mean, even though you can't really change culture, you can be in the same organization or you can be in the same context, different parts of it, and see the culture manifest itself just a little bit differently. So it's not the sort of a thing where you say that if I'm a member of an organization, I'm going to behave like exactly like every other member of the organization, or I'm going to do things the same way. My practices may vary from what is the common understanding of the culture of an organization. So that's how I interpret it soft.
I think that's a good point. That helps me, Tom. And I agree with you. In practice, I've noticed that you will often see commonalities in culture, organizational culture, in large organizations, but you can have very different cultures at the micro or individual level, small unit level of organizations. And that's been my experience, that it would be a mistake to think of organizational culture as this monolithic construct that it's the same for everybody, because many of the work units are following different guidelines and procedures and doing different kinds of work. And therefore, it would be surprising to expect that they have the same culture.
And the social construction comes very much into play, too, because so much of the differences or the variance within an organization's culture, it's the context of the subpart of the organization. And I think that that's becomes very important when we look at, say, the study where they're talking about all different units within larger corporations. So 20 different units within 10 corporations. So you'd expect to see some degree of variance from unit to unit within the same organization. And that's kind of what they found.
Well, one of the things I think it's good to bring up now, even though they have it, this definition is way later in the article. They give Edward B. Taylor quite a bit of credit for having first posed definitions of culture. And I think it's useful at this point to just quote from the paper. They say that, according to Taylor, culture is that complex whole which includes knowledge, beliefs, art, morals, law, customs, and any other capabilities and habits acquired by man as a member of society. So Taylor's looking at culture, maybe the big C for at the societal level. Although there are some who'd say that organizations indicate some level of the culture by the art they have in their display areas or in their entryways to the building. So there's a reflection there of what people think is important and how they want to demonstrate through art.
One of the classes that I took in Delft was actually about design, and I think it was called cultural impact. And one of the ways that from design, so to say, you could look at culture was that culture is a collection of solutions that you commonly face. So, for example, that kind of dishes that you make are just a reflection of your solution to how to feed yourself. That your clothes are just a solution that so to say is locally derived on what how to dress yourself. And I found that back then a really interesting approach, because in the way a culture also has to work in a way to be meaningful, to be helpful.
Well, I think that's a good point for Fridtjof, because Schein, when he writes about culture, one of the things he says is that if you really want to see culture in action, watch how an organization solves problems. And I think that connects very well to what you noted, because it's a collection of things that have worked very well in the past for solving problems. So I think that's a really interesting observation.
I also wonder if that's an analog to the way that Hofstede defined practices. And I'm sort of drawing here on the figure of the text in page 291, where they talk about how their modeling culture, they describe it as kind of like layers of an onion with symbols, heroes, and rituals, and then practices, which can include, you know, how do you solve problems? How do you do things? But how does things done around here? Practices cuts across those other three layers. And the meaning of the layers is essentially the symbols being the most visible and the most shallow is the term that they use, manifestation of culture. And then when you move down to heroes and rituals, it's deeper into the culture. It's much more stronger, more held. And then ultimately, values are at the core. Fridtjof, what you talked about with solutions and solving problems, I think there's an analog there with practices.
Yeah, what I didn't understand about this figure was how are heroes practices?
Well, let's just start by what did they mean by heroes? Heroes are persons, alive or dead, real or imaginary, possessing characteristics highly prized in the culture. And so maybe another way to put it would be exemplars. So if you want to know, like if you're trying to be socialized into an organizational culture, for example, and I'm kind of thinking like, you know, going back to Gideon Kunda and the tech culture, when you socialize, you have to get those, you know, the socialization is done sort of, you're monitoring what's going on around you. And in some way, what you see, what you feel, what you sense is about right, even if it disagrees with your own, you're learning from it. And so hero probably is not in the sense of what we may use as everyday language of what a hero is. It may just simply be an exemplar who you learn to follow. Maybe it's your mentor or the person who brought you into the organization, or maybe it's somebody over there basically espousing what the values are, may not even necessarily be putting into practice themselves.
So I think the other way to look at that is, and I think it complements what Tom said, because I think that was a great way to phrase it, is models, like models for behavior, because it's not just about saying, well, here, you know, this person, such and such a person is our hero. It's organizations will tell lots of stories that you know, that we qualitative researchers love to listen to, and they're very meaningful because they indicate, as Tom was saying, exemplars for behavior that are held up as the model for how others ought to behave. And I'll give you a personal example. When I was in the Navy and learning how to become a nuclear operator, people would tell many Admiral Rickover stories about how we said and did certain things, and those I don't remember the time anybody saying, "Hey, Ralph, you should behave this way," or this is what you should do. But it became clear, like Tom said, after a while through the socialization process, that's the behavior that was valued. Those are the kinds of things you were supposed to do. So that's how I saw it.
Yeah, and the other thing I think is worth mentioning is that you know, we ought to be careful that we don't only latch onto this as sort of a positive thing, because of course, and we saw this in a previous episode on police socialization. That socialization could be negative. I mean, these could be anti-heroes, you know, sort of like a don't be like that person, or could be like there's the espoused culture of what we say is how things are supposed to be done, but then you have sort of like the workarounds and the endarounds that certain people do, and they become the ones that people tend to emulate because they magically get things done, if you know what I mean. So we ought not to say that this is all necessarily good heroism or good symbols. I think, you know, Hofstede was very careful, I believe, not to use value judgments when saying that whether or not a culture is good or bad. It's just simply, what is it?
If we go back to the text, back to Fritjof's earlier point about heroes and practices, heroes are not so much practices, but can manifest in organizational practices, in the discussions or the way employees like or intend to act. And so a hero can be an actual person, as the text says, real or imaginary, but it can also be a kind of person. So, and I think this is what Tom was alluding to, this kind of person is reified in the organization. And it kind of comes out a little bit in page 292 in one of the mini descriptions of the TKB case, when they talk about the old general manager on his daily walk. So obviously, this person has somewhat of a hero figure, whether it's positive or negative, because the employees in the interviews were referencing the manager. And so that's the hero. And then they spoke about how on his daily walk, he would walk through the plant, shaking hands with everyone he met. And so that's almost a ritual. And that ritual has, embedded itself in that particular organizational culture, in that it has been continued by people who still shake hands with colleagues at the start of the day in the morning, even though this doesn't really perform any technical or functional role, but it plays an important social role in the organization.
Because how I had thought about it is that it could also be kind of that the using of symbols, the using of heroes, that these are the practice. But I guess that's similar to what you just said. So that, for example, that at one of the companies I was working at, they, for example, around quality, they would keep quoting the founder who had died long, long time ago, but you would still get his pictures and his quotes about quality to just remind people about what this company is about.
Yeah.
And that's how I kind of understood it, because that's then also, I guess, a form of practice that you keep referring to what this person said a long time ago.
Right. I think that's a good way to sum it up.
Yeah, I also think that the reification is kind of useful, because in some ways, you know, what is that picture on the wall of the founder if the founder is no longer in the organization, or if the founder is long gone? I mean, in a way, he's sort of moving from hero to symbol. That could very well be if, say, the organization has been evolving and moving in directions that are perhaps different from what the founder had envisioned or had intended or what have you. And then, you know, the meaning of having the founder on the wall could very well, you know, maybe the meaning gets lost. And so I think the values that are underpinning all of it, like if you have symbols and rituals that are, say, not aligned with what the organization's values are, then those symbols will tend to lose meaning, and people will forget them and perhaps find new symbols. And that, I think, can even go for, say, the founder's picture.
And that might be an interesting link to the introduction in the beginning, the link between culture and strategy that Weick apparently made. And I think that somehow, at some place also throughout the cases is described that, yeah, if the outside world is changing, then the culture that previously worked so well can be actually a hindrance. So that that you might have to go away from your more normative culture to a more pragmatic culture, because we need to learn to adapt to changing market situation.
Well, I think that's definitely the case, that it's hard to pick a culture that always works for all situations at all times. And I don't necessarily think you have to throw it out, you know, when things change. But like you were saying, Fritjof, you have to think about how you adapt it, or what you would update. One of the things I'd like to just briefly go through the method that they use to produce these six dimensions. They categorized the 20 units that they surveyed into some broad areas. One are private companies, which included manufacturing, electronics, chemicals, or consumer goods. And then they also had 5 units from private service companies, which included banking, transport, trade. And then there were 4 units from public institutions, telecommunications, police, those kinds of things. It's interesting, that perhaps an artifact of when the article was written, that in Denmark and the Netherlands, telecommunications were considered public institutions. That definitely is not the case now anymore in the United States, even though they function like a utility. They're not what I would say public in the same extent that police are. And then the unit sizes varied from 60 to 2,500 people. So they looked at pretty large organizations as well as the smaller ones. They collected their data in three phases. They did in-depth interviews, and they had nine informants per unit and had a range of people that they selected, which were, they were selected not randomly because they were looking for a rich data set. They included questionnaires that covered values, perceived practices, reasons for promotion and dismissal, and this will come back later as when we talk about their conclusions. And they also used questionnaires and interviews to collect unit-level data, basically the statistics and demographics and how big the units were and how many people worked there and those kinds of things. And distinguishing the practices from the values, the values described what the respondents would state as the should-be things of the organization, how things should work. And then the practices were basically what they felt is or what was actually going on in the organization.
Yes, it's quite a comprehensive mixed methods approach. You touched on something there, Ralph, which actually jumped out to me as well in the reading, the non-representative selection of some of the interviewees. And in fact, they say a criterion in the selection was they were assumed to be sufficiently reflective and communicative to be valuable discussion partners.
Oh, yeah, I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, what were your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, remember they made sure that they included the CEOs and their top-level lieutenants and stuff. So I think to some extent, it's hard to say that it affected the data materially, but I think to some extent, based on the way they described the sample selection criteria, it could be a little top-heavy with the senior people. So some of these ideas about the values and that practices could reflect what the senior leaders wanted them to be. They did do interviews with other people. So I just wondered about that a little bit, if their study would change or the results would change much. They seem to think it wouldn't, based on the numerical analysis and data testing things they did. But I just wonder if it would change if it was a completely random sample. You just went to the organization and said, here's what's going on. Because when the a lot of times in the U.S. government, when they do climate surveys, and it also happens in organizations, it's just random. It's just whoever responds. They had a very high response rate of the questionnaires. I think it was about 65%. So I think that's really good for this kind of study. But that's what I was thinking about it, Jared, was, I wonder if we get the same data with a more random sample.
Well, I think it certainly helped to highlight the differences between practices, you know, what we would probably call nowadays as espoused practices as opposed to the perceived practices. So you sort of get within the same unit two different stories from the leadership and the followership, and then you can kind of compare, well, okay, this is what we say, but this is what we really do. And I don't know if that was necessarily intentional, but it certainly came out in the results when they started talking about the importance of perceived practices.
Well, right, and more to Jared's point, there's a line in there where they're talking about the quality of the data and who they were talking to, and they had this sentence in there where they basically concluded, well, that shouldn't affect the outcome much. And I was thinking, what was your basis for that? How would you know that wouldn't affect the outcome since you just did the study this one way? I mean, I really thought that the analyses they did on their data were very rigorous, and for our listeners, it's almost a clinic of for how you do this kind of data collection and analysis and check for bias and variance and those kinds of things. I mean, I think the article went into a lot of really good detail, a little more than what this qualitative researcher normally likes, but I was able to follow, I think, and understand why they were making the choices they made. So you could do this data mix and use the data and do different things, but at least you understand what they did. So I thought that was very well done.
One thing that I actually read somewhere else, a criticism of the, I guess, the methods in the paper was there's a lack or the validation of the scale that they use for organizational practices is not in the paper. And that's missing because the scale was copyrighted by a Dutch consulting firm. And so it was only commercially available. So other people had some difficulty replicating the study and the scale as well and validating it. But that's not really something that occurred to me until after I read the paper and was just browsing more broadly.
That's a good point. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, they seem to be pretty confident about their results based on their analyses of variance and the multivariate analysis, which I thought was interesting and well described. I do want to point out, I think this is a good time to talk about the six dimensions of the perceived practices, because that figures very prominently in their conclusions and discussion. And they make a statement on page 305 that the dimensions can be seen as a checklist for practical cultural differences between organizations. Perhaps, and I'm not sure, but that's an interesting statement. So let me review the six practice dimensions. The first was process versus results, and this is what they call the means orientation, right? Are you more focused on following the rules, or are you more focused on getting the right outcomes? And by the way, they didn't, I think people, somebody said earlier, they didn't say which of these was better or worse. They just said, these are just descriptive. And then these were all in the practice dimensions. The next one was source of identity versus parochial, which means you identify more with the organization, or professional, means you identified more with the class or profession that you're in. Then structure, loose versus tight control. And finally, in the practice dimensions, was customer orientation, normative, which is goes back to inviolable rules that you got to follow, versus pragmatic, you know, to get results and focus on the market. And then the two other dimensions that they came up with were concern for people, which was employee versus job oriented orientation, and then communications climate, open versus closed, which, you know, you could read a lot of things into that one, but that's the last one they come up with. And they said that these six dimensions, according to their data, were independent of the industry. They know that more than we do, because which industries are, you know, figure where in the data wasn't easy to tell by reading the paper. But I did think it was interesting that they said it was independent of the industry, but largely or in many ways more determined by the philosophy of the founders and the top leaders of the organization. And then one thing that I thought was a little surprising to me, and I'm not saying it's wrong, it's just not what my experience has been. And they said on page 308, they say that large organizations with heavy investment in facilities and those kind of things tended to be more employee than job oriented. And that has definitely not been my experience, that the companies with those big investments are very, very focused on the job.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting, though, that, you know, it's not just the type of organization. I look at some organizations that perhaps invested in some of those large buildings or what have you, and they start off as job oriented, but you can almost feel the lever shift as time goes on and the employees start to feel like they're a little bit, you know, disaffected or dissatisfied with the environment because it is so job oriented and impersonal. And so then they try to adjust the climate to shift more to an employee orientation. When I looked at those six factors and looked not just at the factors, but also in the table where they show some of the statements that, as an example, important decisions are made by individuals or organization only interested in work people do. You can imagine how, given the environment, that the culture might position the organization a certain way in terms of those specific items, but that as people do come and go and as conditions change and people become, say, dissatisfied with how things are going, this is a way in which the organization can try to change its culture and say, all right, we're getting either stale, complacent, we're not doing as well as we should be. Let's switch over, you know, let's move the needle a little bit to a different orientation and see if that works.
Yes, Tom, I think we're getting into the discussion about the usefulness of this research, the so what. And that's something I was asking myself as I read the paper. And actually, at the end of the paper, the authors point out that your position on these dimensions, no position is good or bad, but some might be more useful depending on what you're trying to achieve. And this is back to Fritjof's earlier point around culture and strategy. So if the organization has a particular espoused strategy and they review then the organization on these dimensions, they might come to the conclusion that their particular score on one of the dimensions doesn't really support their espoused strategy. So, and they give one or two little examples in the text about, okay, if you are in a service industry, you might tend towards a more customer orientation on one of the dimensions.
Yeah, and you can also imagine how the history of the organization means that you try to move the needle away, but there is, it's almost like gravity. The values of the organization that underlie the culture will drag the needle back. So, like, for example, if you are in a job-oriented, a very job-oriented culture, or even a professional culture, which, I mean, I'm going back to Kunda's example of a tech organization, which was very heavily, you know, in that particular factor, it was very heavily on the professional side. You know, basically, if you wanted to try to make, you know, change the organization to make it more accommodating to a person's needs, may work for a little while, but if you don't change the underlying values, then that's, that change is not going to last very long. And the overwhelming professional orientation, you know, disregard people's private lives, will just reemerge and reemerge with vigor.
Well, and I also wonder not only that, Tom, about the historical aspects and the basis of the founder, but also sometimes I think it's the nature of the work that they do. And some of that's process oriented, but for example, if you have an enormous capital infrastructure for building airplanes or doing manufacturing or those kinds of things, you have to pay a lot of attention to how the machines function and who's using them and what the features of the machines are. And then you have to maintain the machines, and there's processes you have to pay a lot of attention to. So it would seem to me that, as you said, every now and then these kinds of organizations are going to spend so much time looking at that stuff, they're just going to naturally slide towards more process orientation, and they may from time to time try to move towards employee orientation, but it's that dynamic or that process of, okay, here's what the work does and where we have to pay attention, that I think also contributes to that that inability to, or the stickiness of that kind of culture. So I think it comes both from history and also the nature of the work that's done.
But what I was wondering is, isn't there the issue, so to say, with culture that a lot of times you're just not aware of it? So that you only become aware of your own culture when you go to a different culture. So just like you might start working somewhere, I think that's just how work goes. And then once you go somewhere else, then you suddenly realize, oh, wait, maybe this was more unique to this organization.
I think you're right. I think as we were saying earlier, sometimes if you think of culture as that's just the way we do things around here, and you don't have an experience in a lot of different organizations or different organizations other than that one that you're in and different units of it, then you may not be as aware of it. That's actually one of the really nice things about the instrument and these dimensions is I think it takes this, not necessarily fuzzy, but like Tom said earlier, it was helping me, the soft concept of culture, and actually helps flesh it out a little bit more and say, all right, here's some of the attributes, here's some things that you pay attention to that are features of the culture. So I think you have a point there.
But then for me, it's more, it's kind of like with the like color, that at least this gives you a way to talk about some things. And yeah, maybe actually it's not orange, but it's a bit brighter, it's tangerine or whatever. But at least it gives you a way to talk about the different issues. And for example, think about, okay, our Japanese customers or our Japanese colleagues, how might they be different from how we are, and how might we have to deal with that? So for example, that when you ask your Taiwanese colleagues for feedback, that you need to think about how to create a situation where they might be more willing to do that.
Yeah, and I would also say that when you go to a different organization, this is another way to think about what you're taking with you and influencing the organization that you join. So it's not just it's not only that you go to another context and you can see what they're doing, but your presence also has an impact on their culture as well. Because if you're coming into a new organization and you have a particular orientation, let's say that you're going to an organization that's process oriented and you are a results person, I want to see the bottom line. And especially if you're coming in as a new supervisor, your results orientation is going to influence, possibly even conflict, this organization that you're going to. How does the organization respond to that? Are you going to be moving the needle more towards results orientation, or are you going to find yourself back out on the job or back out of the job looking at another organization after just a couple of weeks?
I was, maybe it's a nice example. I was working in the same company, but in two different countries. And so one being the Netherlands, one being Germany. And in the business unit, a new president came who was actually Dutch, and he stopped wearing ties. And apparently, so I've only heard this, but apparently people then started, so to say, from the top management, their business unit, down to the other managers, stopped wearing ties. It just kind of went down through the hierarchy ladders. Because apparently, yeah, people adapted to this new president by also not wearing ties.
Yeah, and you wouldn't necessarily expect that much of a cultural difference between the Netherlands and Germany, would you?
Yeah, that was at least my assumption before moving here. So actually, I'm German, and I've been living in the Netherlands almost as long as I've lived in Germany. And yes, of course, in a lot of ways, we're very similar. But it's a lot of times the subtleties that are quite different. I was talking today to a colleague of mine who noted that, for example, the Dutch, their agenda is often very full. And just if you just call up somebody, hey, you want to do something today, that's usually not possible. And that's something at least not that extreme in Germany. So it's these small kind of differences, even though you're so close to each other.
I think that was a nice example, Fridtjof. Well, actually, I was thinking, is that a ritual, wearing a tie? Or is it a symbol?
I was thinking actually it could be a symbol, it could be hero,
yes.
It could be
but it gives a nice example of how something as holistic as organizational culture can manifest in different organizational practices, such as the ritual of wearing a tie, and the mere act of removing that tie tends to shift the culture slowly from being. Probably if we think of the dimensions in the paper, this probably fits on the tightly versus loosely controlled dimension. And that mere change in ritual starts to shift from one end of the dimension slightly to the other. And so the end result is someone walks into the organization and says, oh, this is a fairly relaxed culture.
That also kind of segues to one part of the paper towards the end that I'm left with some questions, and maybe this is a matter of I'm looking at this from a 2019 lens, and this is of course a 1990 paper, but I look at figure two, and you know, we talk about socialization, we talked about socialization before, and perhaps you know the differences of culture that can be experienced when one moves from organization to organization or a part of an organization to another part within the same organization. And this kind of gets to, you know, where do the values and the practices come from? And this figure sort of depicts how at different levels, you know, we inculcate values from different levels from the nation. And they said, nation to organization with occupation in the middle. So for example, we might be a Dutchman, we belong to a particular organization that is technology, for example. But, you know, our occupation, we might be a computer scientist or we might be a engineer, and that is also a source of values from which we carry into the organization. And then the degrees, you know, the places of socialization on the opposite side, which sort of manifest where we learn practices. We learn some from family, we learn some from school, and we learn some on the workplace. And so, like, for example, when this particular vice president moves from one context to another, he's learned practices associated with one workplace, moving to another nation. Now he's in conflict with the values that are coming from that particular nation as he's trying to inculcate, you know, a change, you know, his own less formal culture. The places of socialization on the right-hand side, family, school, and workplace, I think I know what they're trying to get at, but it's hard to put that into the 2019 context because the way in which we socialize values and practices seems to have changed in the last few decades. So I don't know what you all thought about that.
My first observation was I had a heck of a time figuring out what that line meant between the two. And I've come to the conclusion that it's not meant to be necessarily a slope line that tells you something in particular. I think it just divides the graph in half. That's my first observation. And then my second one is, I agree with you, Tom, that I think fundamentally people still learn their practices and even some of their values in the family and school level. And what I don't think the figure captures very well is how those things change in different ways. And I think I've read some literature, Wyke is one of them, but there are others that talk about how practices can lead into values, right? Because you start to value the things that you do all the time. And so I think, you know, you can have these conflicts, and then we have this whole thing called social media where people have all these other kinds of influences that in some ways is there's a lot of socialization that goes on through that. I don't know how well that's been studied, but it is interesting. And particularly when, if you look at, we've done prior episodes on algorithmic management, and when you don't even know who your boss is, and you're driving around an Uber vehicle, and you don't get to see who the people are you are at the workplace. How does that work as far as socializing you and you know, teaching you practices?
Yeah, it may be that some of the labels, we may be looking at things a little bit differently, because when we talk about where the core of those values are more likely to come from the national context, or say the larger social context, then it will be just my occupation. Whereas the occupation or the organization that I'm in, which translates to the workplace, is where I'm going to learn more about practices. That's where the bulk of my practice is going to come from, is going to be understood from the workplace, as opposed to what I might get from my educational upbringing or from my home. From my home life. My upbringing, for example, in the family side definitely is where I got a lot more of my values, but I don't necessarily put into practice or learn a lot of the practices that I currently do on the job coming from my home upbringing. A lot of that comes from the specific context of the workplace. I think that's where they're trying to draw that line, but it is kind of difficult to follow.
Yes, so I think where this comes from is they're finding that organizations have shared understandings of practices, but not necessarily shared values. And what they say in the paper is this is because values tend to be things formed much earlier in life, as Tom and Ralph have said, at the level of the family, at the level of the nation, and even somewhat a little bit less, the occupation. But actually, values are not significantly influenced by the workplace. However, the practices of the workplace are the element of organizational culture, that are, I guess, more changeable from my reading. And as Tom said, you know, your work practices are not something you tend to learn in your family upbringing. So that line is just saying, okay, the values are less significant at the level of the organization than practices, and then the inverse applies at the level of the nation and the family.
And that concludes part one of episode 54. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Please join us next time as we continue our discussion of Hofstede's classic work on organizational culture, here on Talking About Organizations.